The next phase of development that we did, bearing in mind our policy of being a big firm astride the market, was to merge, and this was a full merger, with a firm called Anchortel Fletcher, who were jobbers in the investment trust market. There were only two jobbers in this particular firm, in this particular market, and we examined it and we thought this was a good market to be in, and we entered into a full merger arrangement. The reason why they wanted to merge was the usual business of having their capital in the hands of elderly partners, of feeling the need for bigger capital, for having the access to bigger capital resources, and the acceptance of the view that we shared, that the development of the stock exchange was such as to benefit the larger firm being astride all markets, so that you were not unduly affected if any particular market went for any particular reason outside one's own control, such as politics or economic management or whatever, that any particular market went dormant. Our final merger, which again I think all these took place I believe in the 60s, was with a firm called George Atkin. This was a firm that dealt in the very profitable brewery market. The disadvantage was that the opposition was with Durlacher, who, as you can imagine, after 10 years of a successful merger, or whatever it was, something like 10 years at that particular time, was a very successful and powerful competitor. Atkin was again, for exactly the same reasons as Anchortel, if I remember right, wanted this merger. We had a full merger. I had known the senior partner, who was the deputy chairman, and I had known him as a co-council member. And the merger worked very successfully. They came into the office. That we merged our businesses, we inherited a very efficient small office which we blended into our own. They were very advanced as an office, advanced in computer technology, and they helped us to create a computer-based office, dealing with both account stocks and the more difficult, from a mechanical computerized point of view, the more difficult gilt-edged settlement tomorrow stocks.
Now, so by now you'd more or less completed the phase of mergers that you had passed through. About how big was Ackroyd's? Was it one of had it become one of the bigger jobbing firms?
Oh yes, it had by then, certainly. I don't know in terms of figures how big it was. All I know that I had to produce some figures about 4 or 5 years ago, and if I remember right, by 1978, Ackroyd employed 390 staff. That figure included a number of dealers, etc., on the floor of the stock exchange. Because by that time we were a limited liability company, and therefore we were structured in the form of a board and employees.
About when had you become a limited liability company?
We became a listed company in 1975. Mm. I seem to remember that before then we were a limited liability private company. Mm. We were only, I don't know exactly when that took place. It wasn't very many years ago, because we were, of course, controlled by the stock exchange.
Yes.
In becoming limited liability.
Yes.
And there were certain special provisions applied to stock exchange limited liability companies, for instance, in order to preserve the unlimited liability nature of a trading company within the stock exchange, and in order not to be able to be accused of imposing a degree of favoritism on a limited liability company. The stock exchange made all the directors of that limited liability company, made them assume unlimited liability for the debts of the company. And that was achieved by special rule.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe a little bit the background to Ackroyd becoming a limited liability company?
Yes. Again, this was emerged from our thinking aspect of trying to make make certain that Ackroyd and Smithers was adequately equipped to deal with the future. We had a number of reasons for this. First of all, the people with capital in the firm were the older people. It was unlikely that they would want to, that when they retired, they would want to leave all their capital in. It was quite reasonable to assume that they would leave some of their capital in, because after all, the company had provided a employment and a way of life for them for all the period of their working, and so that when they retired, it was reasonable to hope that they would leave some of the capital. But that capital wasn't going to be all that was the company would require. The pressures on the stock exchange, because of the change that we'd referred to previously of the predominance, of the dominance of the market by the small investor, because of the change that had taken place, was that the taxation incentives that had been given to corporate savings of pensions, of life insurance, etc. The profile of the market had changed completely. It was no longer a market made up of relatively small bargains. Each produced by clients, where a variety of different interests affected at any one time. It was dominated now by institutions, with inflation, with tax incentives, showed absolutely no sign of the tendency for those institutions to grow naturally. It showed no sign of that tendency being reversed whatsoever. The effect on the profile of the market meant that was twofold, really. First of all, the bargains that were done by these people were infinitely bigger, therefore required infinitely greater financial requirements. Secondly, you will perhaps have heard about the criticism of institutional fund managers that certainly existed in the 70s and exists in part, as I understand it now, the sheep-like tendency of them all tending to do the same thing at the same moment. Now, I understand about that. That's not meant to be in any way a degree of criticism of fund managers. They have two things which activate them in this way. First of all, and this is a minor consideration, there is the degree of cross-directorships. You get an individual who is a director of one institution who attends a board meeting in 1 week, and he hears that his fund manager say that after reflection and analysis by his research team, the institution's research team, he has decided that he would sell the shares of XYZ because he thought they were overpriced. And that particular board member, non-executive board member, takes that on board as he is meant to do, and maybe makes an observation, maybe asks a question, assures himself that it's the right answer. But there's a cross directorship, and he goes in 2 weeks' time to another savings institution, and he knows that that savings institution has a similar fund, and so he sees that that hasn't been sold, and naturally it's part of his duty to ask, has the fund manager considered this or that or the other situation? Inevitably, there is a sort of sheep-like mentality. That's one way it rises. It also arises, of course, from the fact that institutions now, and particularly the bigger savings institutions, as they got bigger, increase their size, have their own research departments and don't necessarily rely solely on the broker. And their research departments operate primarily on the same basic fund of information. And if a basic fund of information says that the XYZ shares are overpriced, you would expect both the research departments of both institutions to come up to their fund managers with a recommendation to sell. So that inevitably there is a much greater sheep-like mentality of all selling at the same time than ever you had when the market was dominated by private individuals who relied upon the stockbrokers' research departments to advise them, and not all the these research departments of all the brokers got onto the same thing at the same time.
So Aykroyd decided that the best way of coping with this was by achieving greater capitalization, and
had to make certain of your capital. Now, we found that the partners, the older partners, were retiring. We had some good younger partners, but they didn't have access to capital resources. The only availability of capital resources was the public. Therefore, it seemed totally logical to take advantage of the stock exchange rules, become a listed liability company, have access to the capital markets, the public, when you wanted it. The individual partners and things then had shares that you were no longer responsible for. The senior partners, the management, were no longer responsible if an aging partner wanted to reduce his interest. You no longer had the responsibility of having to find a member of the stock exchange with resources to buy them, or somebody connected to buy them. He could do that through the market in the normal way, the normal controlled way.
Would you say this had been one of the main problems for jobbing firms previously, that there had been older partners who had got to the point where they decided they want to retire and take their capital out?
And there's nothing wrong with that. It wasn't the question of the profitability of the firm's concern. It was really a reflection of the compensatory, confiscatory taxation policies of the governments in the late 40s and 50s.
How had your career with Aykroyd unfolded since the merger?
My career in Aykroyd really didn't alter very much, which sounds a funny thing to say, I suppose. But when I was, after I had disengaged, dissolved the merger from Aykroyd and Smithers point of view, I became, because I think perhaps of my personal qualifications and everything, I was put in charge of the administration. The office manager tended to talk to me on day-to-day matters, on policy matters. Of course, he went to the senior partner. Although never actually described as such, I became, as it were, Hugh Merriman's number two. I took his place in the Gilt Edge market when he was absent. And that was in 1956, and I remained his number two until he retired in 1975. I used to combine the floor, jobbing on the floor, with the responsibilities in the office until the debacle with James Case. And then they needed a partner in the office all the time in order to sort out this this problem that we had with the mechanization within the office. It wasn't James Case's fault. It was entirely due to the mechanization. I was in the office then, and then in 1961 I went into the council, and that began to take a lot of the time, because the technique employed by the council was that its council members had to attend, were allotted to various committees covering the range of responsibilities within the council. Committees met either in the mornings or immediately after lunch in the afternoons. Sometimes we all had lunch together, the committees had lunch together. You couldn't really satisfactorily run a book and be off and have to be off the floor of the house, because the market is an alive thing, and you have to be there to spot, to feel sometimes, without ever knowing why, feel the changes that occur. Many of the older people could walk into the old Stock Exchange. I don't know that it quite applied to the new one, but certainly the old Stock Exchange. And from the very nature and degree of the noise in that Stock Exchange, they could tell whether a market was running or not, whether it was bubbling, or whether it was in the last stages of despair. A fascinating sort of feeling. You had to be there all the time. If you were responsible for running a book, you had to be there. Your moments of turning that book or taking a position only occurred when the jobber was in front, when the broker was in front of you. You might make a broker a price, and he might turn away, and you might be wanting to buy back stock, even at a loss, because you thought the market was going to go better. And as he turns away, you've got to have the feeling that perhaps he's a dealer, and perhaps he might sell if you just raise your bid price a little. Now, you can't do that sitting upstairs doing committee work. So that then I began to be responsible within Aykroyd much more for the general administration. And by that time, of course, the firm had got very much bigger. And there was a need for a partner to be available.
Yes.
To control the staff, to provide support for the manager, and to make certain that the integration was being achieved efficiently. Because so often when you get to it, it isn't only the chemistry of the partners, It's the chemistry of the staff, right the way through. Otherwise, you get a loss of morale, a dip in morale. You get a feeling that the people upstairs, to use a television expression, the people upstairs don't really know what's going on. You've got to have somebody there who's spotting it and feeling it and watching it and available to people for as much as a day as you can. The bigger you get, the more necessary.
Now, had staff problems, management problems become more important
The bigger you get.
By the 1970s, the early 80s?
Well, yes, because people were getting bigger, firms were getting bigger. I mean, what I would say that they were becoming important, they were beginning to become important at the beginning of the 60s. But grew in importance as we got bigger and as the strains and stresses of market activity, of volume of stocks, of turnover and everything else like that got greater.
Well, now briefly to conclude this particular stage of our conversation, how would you have characterised Ackroyd at more or less the year in which you retired, 1980, 1981, thinking about the firm as you had joined it when the merger with Blackwell had taken place?
Oh, it was chalk and cheese. It was quite a different animal. To begin with, we were a listed company in 81, had been a listed company for 6 years. We were subjected to all the criteria, the rules, the regulations, the expectations that the stock exchange as a whole had on the on its listed companies. And it was quite right and proper, and a number of people thought that it was a pity that we went that route. But it was actually, I personally believe, absolutely right that some of the bigger firms in the stock exchange should have subjected themselves to the same discipline that the stock exchange applied on outside companies. So that it was that. It was also, we had begun to think again, as I was saying, that we were perhaps a thinking firm. We had begun to think about what was going to happen, whether the stock exchange could remain in its present form. Don't forget that I said that in 1978 the number of jobbing firms had been reduced to 14, even though the number of dealers was not all that, not sufficient, they were not relatively proportionately reduced. The outside world was getting worried about the viability of the jobbing system as such. The it wasn't just the outside world sees as the coat as the peg on which to hang their coat of criticism. The fact that capital was getting short. But in fact, so far as Ackroyd and Smithers are concerned, I have said on many occasions that I couldn't, even at that time, let alone now, I couldn't remember at any time refusing to do an order because of lack of capital. What actually happened then was quite often that the fund managers sending their brokers in with a big order had got fixed in their mind a price below which they were not prepared to sell stock. But their assessment of the risk and the jobber's assessment of the risk quite often did not actually coincide. The volatility of the market was something that the jobbers had to assess, and they didn't always come to the same conclusion as the fund managers. There was a conflict of interest, of course. If the jobbers took the stock, they had to take it at a level where, notwithstanding that, where even though it might take 3 or 4 days to unload, they could still unload at a profit. The fund managers were only concerned of what they dealt with at the moment. and very, very few of them took the longer view. You can understand it, it's a perfectly natural thing. What was wrong was the conclusion that they came to was that the capital in the market would have made some difference. It doesn't matter how much capital you make. You actually, when you buy stock, you have to buy it at a price that you hope and will be able to achieve to sell it at a profit. So it wasn't really capital.
Yes.
Obviously, the level of capital had to be such that kept your bank managers happy. It also happened to be at a level that enabled you to sleep peacefully at night, which you didn't do if ever you thought that you were overtrading.
Now, we had, by this stage, five big jobbers. Wed Durlacher, Smiths, Bisgood Bishop, Pinch and Denny, and yourselves, Aykroyd. What would you have said briefly was distinctive about Aykroyd, if anything? You said you were the thinking jobbers.
I don't know. It's awfully difficult to say when one is giving an opinion for posterity. and you're going to ask the same question to all the other four. I don't know what was particularly our the facet that would have distinguished us, except to say again that I think that we perhaps were regarded as thinking more about trends and analysing them, and perhaps not being such rugged traders as some of the others that you mentioned.
Were you covering most markets?
Well, no, because as I said, we didn't cover the CAFA market. We didn't cover we did cover Australians. There were various other sections that we didn't cover. But what we did cover was a significant part of the industrial equity market, and it was sufficient to balance the business that was very big as the deficits became financed, as the bank began more and more to use the market to achieve the monetarism. There was a policy that was to mopping up the money, you know, the available money, by pushing gilts, the level of gilts down, so that they became attractive for people to buy. And generally using the gilt edge market as a means of influencing their monetary management.
I think we'll break here.